Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Today on WILL AM 580, we've got a live show for you today. So please do call in if you have questions or comments. Our number, of course, 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Over the past 10 or 15 years, the conservative movement has generated an enormous body of work in this country, both in print and on radio and television, lambasting liberals and Democrats and people they oppose. And for the most part, the response has been tepid. But recently, in the past 2 or 3 years, especially since George W. Bush became president, and even more so in the past year, a number of writers, Paul Krugman, Joe Connison, Molly Ivins, Al Franken, have responded to the conservative attack on liberals and liberalism and defense of conservatives with a number of books. And today our guest is going to be the author of one of these books, and a book I've just had an opportunity to read and I strongly recommend to you, Joe Connison. Joe Connison is the national correspondent for the National Observer, and he writes a daily online journal for Salon. With Gene Lyons, he's the best-selling author of The Hunting of the President, the 10-year campaign to destroy Bill and Hillary Clinton. He's written for many publications, Harper's, The Guardian, The Nation, The New Republic, and now he has, as I said, this new book just come out and a bestseller, Big Lies, The Right-Wing Propaganda Machine, and How It Distorts the Truth. Joe Connison, welcome to Media Matters. Joe? All right. Well, we were waiting to get Joe. I thought we had him online, but apparently we've got to push a couple buttons in there to get him with us. Oops. We're shooting for Joe now. So while we're working to get Joe here, let me just give some updates on where we're at with the show Media Matters and what we're up to. Upcoming guests include Paul Krugman, who we've referred to, the columnist for The New York Times, who also has a new book out concerning similar to Connison's in the sense that it deals with a critique of where the current administration is taking the country. Paul Krugman will be our guest in December. Two other guests who've written very similar themed books, Jim Hightower and Molly Ivins, are also going to be guests in November and December. If you're getting a sense of a pattern here, yes, there is a pattern. We're seeing in the midst of an enormous body and wave of books responding critically to the conservative attack. And today's guest, Joe Connison, I think, has probably written as good an example of this, as fine an example of this caliber of writing as you're going to get. And I'm eager to talk with Connison about it as soon as we get him back on the line. I think we lost our connection momentarily, so we're in the process of getting him right now. And I think we're moments away from getting Joe Connison to join us. Yes, we are. Joe Connison?
Hello.
Hey, welcome to Media Matters.
Thank you very much.
It's really a pleasure to have you here. I've been touting you while we've been trying to make this connection, so you've missed all the accolades.
Oh, well, that's probably just as well. I'd be embarrassed, but thank you, whatever you said.
Well, I've had the pleasure of reading Big Lies, your new book, over the past few days. And in fact, I'm writing a book myself on current media issues. And your chapter on the so-called liberal media was, I thought, very well put together, very thoughtful and well written.
Thank you.
And it's one of, so people get a sense, the book is basically built around a series of what you call distortions or myths or lies that are perpetrated and trying to respond to those. Is that an accurate way to put it?
That's a very accurate and pithy way to
put it. Big lies. You know, before we go through the book and some of the big lies or the myths that you expose and talk about, I want to just raise a couple other issues just to get the ball rolling. You wrote a well-known book, The Hunting of the President, with Gene Lyons, about the effort to destroy Bill and Hillary Clinton. How would you compare the press coverage that Bill Clinton has received when he was president to the press coverage that George W. Bush has received?
Well, you know, it's night and day. But then again, we're living in a different time. I think it was natural, particularly after September 11th, for the president to receive somewhat less criticism than perhaps presidents ordinarily do, because people felt that the country had been attacked and we were at war and all of that. But the truth is that the honeymoon that Bush had actually started long before that. As I say in the book, the soft treatment of Bush from the very moment that he was inaugurated, and for that matter, long before, but it became so obvious that there was an incredible contrast between the way the Washington Press Corps had treated Clinton and the way they were treating Bush, that John Harris at the Washington Post wrote a long sort of apologia
Yeah, I remember that was in May of 2001.
Yeah, on behalf of the press, sort of saying, well, yes, my friends have all been telling me that we're laying down for Bush and we were killing Clinton, and I can't deny it anymore. So here's my reasoning as to why that is. And basically he laid it off on the liberals themselves for not being as loud and insistent and sort of out to get Bush as the conservatives had been towards Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really, in my view, I think John Harris is actually a pretty smart guy, but that was a very feeble excuse. I mean, the press is really not supposed to respond solely to pressures from the outside, but that was a remarkable and very important article, not because it explained anything about what the press had done from their point of view, but because it showed what the press has become now in this period, which is a very responsive to pressure institution that is part of the political spectrum itself, they're almost like politicians now, the journalists, both in their self-regard and in their response to outside pressures and to commercial pressures. And I think that's very important for citizens to understand, because I've been going around the country selling the book and speaking at bookstores and talking to people, and one of the questions I get at every appearance is, what can we do about the media? And the answer is, bring pressure on them, because they will respond to it. They now acknowledge that they respond to that, and they have, that's what has shaped them in the past 20 years, which is an enormous amount of pressure from the right. And I think if liberals and progressives organize themselves to do the same thing, they'll have a very good result. I think the coverage has changed now to a degree. Bush is getting much tougher coverage. Part of that is the intrusion of reality in terms of the economy and especially events in Iraq, but also the journalists and the editors and producers look at the bestseller lists and they see that there is a strong public for a progressive or liberal point of view, that in fact it's not a conservative country, it's a divided country, and that point of view deserves to be represented. I think that's been a beneficial thing of these books coming out and succeeding. Mine's only one of several.
No, in fact, we're sort of lining them all up on this program every week. It's been wonderful for me. Unfortunately, though, it's not many other talk show hosts are doing this, and that, because the majority of talk show programs in this country have a political perspective where basically your viewpoint would be banned or if covered only so they could hurl insults and invective at you. This is sort of part of the split you're talking about. I mean, we have, by loose count, 1,500 conservative talk radio programs on commercial radio in the United States, and I don't know the exact count of non-conservative ones, but I think you can do it on one hand, certainly on two hands, before you've exhausted the whole list. How do you explain this, that the bestseller list has books like your own and Molly Ivan's and Al Franken's and Paul Krugman's, and then to turn on the AM radio in this country, you are basically bombarded with political viewpoints that are not just moderately conservative, but oftentimes much more conservative than even the national conservative figures?
Well, I think a lot of it is sort of trend mongering over the last 10 or 15 years, where a lot of the AM radio ownership realized, they looked at Rush Limbaugh's success and they thought, we'll do the same thing. I mean, the media is, for all of its touting of itself as a creative institution, they're actually much more inclined to imitation than creation, both in television and in radio. And so Rush's success, just gigantic commercial success, spawned many, many imitators and a willingness to give airtime to those people on the theory that if Rush was making a lot of money for the people sponsoring him, and then, we could do the same if we found another Rush or somebody like Rush or somebody who was willing to sound like Rush. And I think that has led to spawn at a time when liberalism itself seemed to be in eclipse, particularly in the Reagan era. So I think that's one very important reason. The other reason, of course, is that, commercially, The talk radio phenomenon developed as a response to conservatives feeling excluded from what they called the mass media, from the network TV. They insist that network television is very liberal, although I would certainly dispute that. And this was their alternative. It's mm-hmm. a function, you know, there are several different explanations for it that range from the psychological to the commercial. And I think all of them have some truth in them. But I think you're going to see now that there will be a resurgence of some kind of liberal radio. And mm-hmm. there are two reasons for that. One is we know it has succeeded in some markets. You said you can count them on one hand, but or two hands, and you're probably right about that. But the people that you find in those markets are very successful. Randy Rhodes in Miami, as she likes to say, kicks Rush Limbaugh's butt every day. And she is a fighting liberal talk host in the Miami Beach market and does extremely well in the Miami market. Bernie Ward in San Francisco has a tremendous following. He's called the Lion of the Left mm-hmm. on KGO. I know these people because I've been on all their shows month or two. I've actually been on most of their shows before. Mm-hmm. Ed Schultz in the Upper Midwest, tremendous following. And it's interesting, you know, these, I don't know about Bernie, but Randy and Ed Schultz, Randy Rhodes and Ed Schultz are both on Clear Channel.
Mm-hmm.
And Clear Channel won't put them on national syndication.
Yeah.
Because it's a right-wing company.
Absolutely.
It's owned by... largely by a investment bank that's run by a man named Thomas Hicks, who is one. He and his brother and their associates are among the largest contributors to George W. Bush and the Bush family historically, and have won tremendous benefits as a result of that association going back to when Bush was governor of Texas. They're based in Dallas, and so they're not going to promote liberal radio. Tom Hicks is very conservative, and they will actually suppress liberal radio, even though they probably could make some money from it. So there's an ideological as well as a commercial issue here. But I think eventually somebody's going to come up with enough money and realize that they could both promote a point of view that they want to promote and make money at it. And I believe that'll happen.
We're talking to Joe Connison today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Joe Connison is the author of the new book, Big Lies, the Right-Wing Propaganda Machine and How It Distorts the Truth. If you'd like to call in and speak with Joe Connison, have a question or comment, the number 333-9455, our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line 1, Champagne, you're on the air with Joe Connison.
Hi. I hope you won't mind if I connect this show with the previous one, with interview with Alexander Coburn.
No, go right ahead.
And okay, so I didn't agree 100% with the last caller who called in last week. I think one can oppose Israel's founding or question its ideology as well as its particular policies by the government, and you can call for a transformation of it without being anti-Semitic. But I was really offended by Alexander Coburn when he said, well, would you rather be a Jew in France or an Arab? I think we have to recognize that anti-Semitism, especially in France, can be a double-edged sword. And so then I just like to connect that with asking your guests how he thinks the press is doing on two issues regarding religion or ethnicity, both handling issues of Israel and anti-Semitism, for example, the U.S. News and World Report article that just came out, or the Christian right and the question of religion and foreign policy and whether that's being delved into or questioned, you know, whether, you know, foreign policy is about domination or the last Anno Domino, you know, the end of the world. And whether that temple's going to be rebuilt. So what, there is something...
That's a complicated... I mean,
it sure is.
That,
yeah.
I'm not sure I even understood the whole question, but...
Maybe we can boil it down to...
I haven't read the U.S. News article, although I saw it in the airport this week, and I didn't buy it, and I didn't read it.
What is the article on, Joe?
It's a cover story called The New Anti-Semitism.
Okay.
And so I haven't read it, and I don't know what it says. As far as Alexander Coburn is concerned, the Jewish people are very fortunate that other people have been more concerned with their survival than Alexander Coburn ever has been. I know him very well, and as a Jew myself, I would scarcely trust him to look out for the interests of Jews in any context. That said, I do believe that the U.S. media is largely tilted in favor of Israel, to a degree that has slighted Palestinian concerns over the years. I think it's improved, and it is more even-handed than it used to be. But I think it is still, the presumption is still is too much in favor of Israel, and there's I think too little coverage of the damage that Israeli policy has done to the peace process, along with the terrorism and suicide bombings that have damaged the efforts towards peace from the Arab side. So, and these are very complex issues. I think, you know, Jewish extremism in Israel probably deserves more coverage than it's gotten from the American media. And I actually think that it would be very healthy if Jews and everybody else in America understood that in Israel itself, there is a very large number of people, Israeli Jews, who are in favor of a two-state solution, believe that the settlements policy of the present government is an obstacle to that, and would like to see a serious, you know, negotiation towards a real and just peace there. That, it seems to me, is something that too many Americans don't understand, both Jews and non-Jews.
Yeah, my sense has always been that Israel's had, ironically, a much broader range of debate on the issue than the United States has had.
Yes, it has. I mean, that changed to a degree when labor governments were in power in Israel, and the mainstream Jewish organizations in this country realized that they were going to have to choose between the policies that they'd endorsed in the past and supporting the actual state of Israel and its government. And to their credit, most of them chose to support the state of Israel's decision to engage in real talks and change the long-term position towards the Palestinians and towards a viable two-state solution. And now that the government has changed to the right, you know, a lot of those positions have changed back again. But, you know, even Sharon has admitted that this is an occupation and that it can't last and that there has to be a two-state solution. These are people who never admitted that there was such a thing as a Palestinian years ago. So I think there's been some progress, and I think that the American media coverage has contributed to that progress to a degree. I do think there needs to be tougher coverage of the right-wing government in Israel, because I think a lot of things they're doing are incredibly destructive and in my view, immoral.
We're talking to Joe Connison today on Media Matters. He's the author of the new book, Big Lies, The Right-Wing Propaganda Machine and How It Distorts the Truth, which goes through a chronicle of some of the main assertions of the right in its own, what he calls, propaganda campaign. And I think this title is a little misleading. I don't know if you came up with it, because it suggests that you're going to return fire with the same sort of bombast that Ann Coulter or Bill O'Reilly delivers, when in fact this is, I would say, a very sober book and very measured in your prose. And I would recommend it for people who want that approach rather than one of, because I think there is a place for bombast, but this isn't the book to go to find it, I don't think.
Well, you know, some people think, I mean, the book, for example, I was on television with Tim Russert a couple of weeks ago, and he took a look at chapter 6, which is called Private Lives and Public Lies, about the morality scam of the right wing, their incredible hypocrisy on issues of personal morality. And as he looked at me and he said, "This is a very hard-hitting chapter, Joe," as if, you know, I might have gone a step too far. And I know other people have said that too. So I think there are portions of the book that are, if not bombastic, are pretty, they're pretty tough on the right. And I hope, you know, I crack a few jokes at their expense too. I was very gratified that Paul Krugman reviewed the book in the New York Review of Books this week and said he found it both gripping and hilarious. But I think, I would hope that I would be, as a journalist, more accurate than these faux journalists like Ann Coulter and company, who have no journalistic background at all, and in my opinion, very little commitment to accuracy and factuality. And that as an intellectual, I would, you know, rise above the level that they've achieved as well. I would hope. I wouldn't say I have, but I would hope that I could.
You set a higher bar, in other words.
I try to, and I think. But I also think And I also hope that I, you know, hit back hard, because they've been asking for it. And as I say in the introduction of the book, I make no apology if they don't like it, because they've been asking for it for a long time.
Well, let's go into that particular issue, because this has come up with Rush Limbaugh's recent problems.
Right.
You know, for years, conservatives have been painting themselves as sort of the voices of morality and liberals. I mean, the famous line in Newt Gingrich back in 1992, and he said Woody Allen was the Democratic Party's sort of moral leader.
Yes.
When he had the
affair with his
stepdaughter.
Yes.
Yeah. And, you know, this has been sort of propagated. And, you know, what is your response to that?
Well, my response to that is twofold. One is that when this is portrayed as a pro-family issue, that one's personal morality determines whether one is pro-family or not, I think that's a terribly misleading thing. I think what makes a political leader or an elected official pro-family is whether they pursue policies that help families. And in my view, those policies include strengthening Social Security and improving medical care and extending, you know, health insurance coverage and student loans and better preschool and all the kinds of things that make it easier for families to stay together and to prosper and to, you know, look forward to a better future. To me, those are the pro-family policies. The idea that Newt Gingrich, who's now had three families, is more pro-family than, say, Bill Clinton, who was stuck with his one family through thick and thin, and they've stuck with him, is just absurd. And I discuss Newt Gingrich's history in great detail, because he used this pro-family morality issue in 1994 very effectively and said that, you know, Susan Smith, who drowned her children in Georgia, could only be stopped. I'm sorry, in South Carolina, I guess, could only be that kind of thing could only be stopped and if people voted for Republicans, because this was a sign of the diminishing morality of the country under Democratic misrule. Well, it turned out that Susan Smith was the stepdaughter of a Republican county official, a man who was active in the Republican Party in their county in South Carolina, and a leader of the Christian Coalition, who had been molesting her sexually, raping her basically, since she was a teenager. And she had tried to commit suicide at least once before this terrible incident where she killed her children. And I just thought, boy, this is exactly the kind of guy who loves Newt Gingrich. You know, if he'd been in Georgia, he would have been on, you know, the Newt Gingrich committee.
Yeah.
And yet this is the kind of advantage that Newt took of this tragedy. So, you know, I've been fed up with that for 10 years. And I thought, okay, this book is a chance to talk about Newt Gingrich and the misuse of the issue of personal morality as a political weapon by people who could not stand up to the scrutiny for 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Dante had an idea about what was going to happen to the likes of Newt Gingrich. There is a very hot circle of hell that is reserved for people like him. And, you know, I'll tell you, I'm not sorry I wrote about that. I enjoyed writing about that.
Yeah. So. Well, he's not alone. He has.
Oh, no. I have a long list of them in there.
Yeah, and since the book's come out, there's some new people to join the club.
Well, Bill Bennett.
Yeah.
But see, now, this is an interesting question, because Bill Bennett, of course, appears to be a gambling addict.
Mm-hmm.
And Rush Limbaugh, we know, is now addicted to what's called hillbilly heroin, or OxyContin. And I personally don't regard those as issues of morality. To me, these are illnesses. And I think clearly Rush Limbaugh is extremely ill. You know, he has a treatable disease that requires various kinds of therapy. Gambling is also regarded as a disease. I don't know as much about that as I do about drugs. But the funny thing is, of course, it's the right that treats these as issues of morality.
Yeah.
And the left recognizes them as medical issues. And now, of course, we are being asked by the right to regard Rush Limbaugh's problem as a medical problem. And they're right about that. Now, the fact that they're hypocritical about it doesn't mean that they're wrong. It just means that, what, from my point of view, I wish they would look at it and say, oh, you know, we were wrong before.
Yeah.
We need to change our view of this. Because somebody that we revere, and they're entitled to revere Rush Limbaugh, you know, that's fine. but recognize what's really happened here.
Yeah.
And what the meaning of it is. And, of course, they can't do that.
We're talking to Joe Connison today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Joe Connison, the author of the new book, Big Lies, The Right-Wing Propaganda Machine and How It Distorts the Truth. We're taking phone calls. If you'd like to call in, the number 333-9455. The toll-free number and the toll-free line is open, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 1, Champaign, you're on the air with Joe Connison.
Good morning. I'm really enjoying the show today. And I just have a quick question. I read an article recently, and I'm sorry, I can't remember who or where, but the gist of the article was basically that these events with Rush Limbaugh and the allegations against Arnold Schwarzenegger, that the right defense for these individuals has begun the end of the culture war between the right and the left. And I was just curious if you think that is true or if you think that right wing will continue along the path that they have been on all this time, as you were saying before, painting the left as immoral and as only right wing as pro-family and...
I think it will be tough. I mean, I think it's grown tougher because the hypocrisy is too obvious and the case is very, very well known. You know, Newt Gingrich's marital problems were just never got the kind of coverage that Clinton's problems did, obviously. And so for a while after that, they could get away with it. But the Bennett and Limbaugh issues have gotten tremendous coverage. And so I think... for a while, at least, it'll be tough for them to do that. Also, I have to say, as far as I know, all of the Democratic candidates for president who would be the natural next targets for anything like that next year are squeaky clean. You know, they're all, as far as I know, they are all, you know, married for a long time, not suspected of womanizing. Probably none of them are drug addicts and I doubt that any of them spend a lot of time gambling. So I think they're in a position where I actually think the issue that the right has been focused on for the last year or two has been patriotism rather than personal morality.
And you do talk about that in the book, that the vision that Ann Coulter, I think, has taken it to the most extreme possible.
Yes, that we're all traitors.
Liberals are, in fact, traitors. I mean, treason. They should be, by logic, locked up and imprisoned.
Or hung. Yeah.
I mean, that's an extreme position, but I think there's a more subtle position that gets the same idea, that those who are Republican or conservative are more patriotic to what this country stands
right.
for.
Yes, and of course, I mean, I have a chapter about that called Male Cheerleaders and Chicken Hawks, in which I discuss, among other things, the relative... The comparative military service records of members of Congress, because it seemed to me that that was a measurable way of looking at patriotism. It's not that people who serve in the military are more patriotic necessarily, but it does show a certain commitment to your country if you do serve. And I thought, well, let's compare the Democrats and liberals with the Republicans and conservatives and see who served and who won medals for valor and all the rest. And I'll tell you, the Democrats and liberals came out ahead, particularly if you subtract the Vietnam-era National Guard service that was so popular among the Republicans as a way of avoiding the war. So, and I examined some other issues in that chapter, too, but it seems, you know, the idea that people who wave the Confederate flag still, who were considered traitors by Abraham Lincoln, are more patriotic than... those of us who believe in the Union and, you know, the Constitution and the progress that the country's made in the last 200 years, as slow and painful as it's been, that they are more patriotic than we are is laughable. And I demonstrate that historically in the book, and I think it's irrefutable that we're every bit as patriotic as they are. And I would say possibly just a little bit more.
All right. We've got Joe Connison here, our guest on Media Matters, the author of Big Lies, The Right-Wing Propaganda Machine and How It Distorts the Truth. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air with Joe Connison.
Hi, Joe and Bob. I just wanted, well, you know, this might be a little bit overly simplistic the way I'm boiling this down, but you said earlier that, you know, you think that there's money out there to be made in the liberal radio market. And I just wanted to know, you know, the right wing seems to have sort of a monopoly at this point, you know, not only a financial monopoly on the market, but also sort of an ideological monopoly because, you know, they've got their ideas out there that they're furthering by, you know, buying up more radio stations, promoting their message, making more money and buying up more radio stations. So, I mean, I look at that as sort of a monopoly. And I say, well, the only way to bust up a monopoly is do you have somebody from the government, let's say, come in and say, well, that's a bad idea. But then, you know, you look at what's going on in the FCC now is you've got the administration and the FCC both, you know, backing up what's been going on in the right-wing media, which is where we want them to get bigger, you know, because we want them to support our campaigns, and we're going to allow that to happen. So I guess my question to you is, you know, what do you think is going to be the shift in paradigm that's going to allow this left-wing radio market to come back?
Well, I don't know if it's a shift in paradigm. I mean, there's a big radio spectrum out there, and they are far from owning everything, although they have quite a bit, particularly in the AM spectrum. But, you know, already the second largest radio audience after Limbaugh is National Public Radio, which I don't think is particularly liberal, but the other side regards it as very liberal,
yeah.
And it certainly gives a voice to liberals. And so I think it's clear that there is, and by the way, NPR, is, although it's nonprofit, is tremendously financially successful. I mean, they you know, you look across the spectrum of NPR, and there are people who are being paid real salaries, and they collect a tremendous amount of money, so, and get sponsorships and all the rest, because although they don't call them advertising sponsors, they have them. They've said, you know, this hour is brought to you by so and so. So it's clear that there is another kind of radio market out there, and I just believe that, particularly in certain types of markets, you're going to find somebody realizes we could make money with a left or liberal talk show if we have the right kind of host, which Ed Schultz or Randy Rhodes might very well be, or any of a number of people. Mike Malloy in Chicago was very successful too. I just think that's going to happen because of market forces. And we don't have the fairness doctrine anymore, which I think is too bad, because the airwaves belong to the people, and there should be some, you know, serious regulation of this. But you know, absent that and a Congress that would restore that someday, I think market forces will actually bring some liberal points of view to people sooner or later. And I think it'll be sooner.
Joe, what's your sense of the 2004 presidential race, if you have one as a journalist covering politics right now? I mean, for a long time, it was sort of put out that President Bush was going to be unbeatable.
Never believed that.
But that has turned. Now there's a sense that he is, in fact, perhaps quite beatable. What's your take on it, and what's your sense of the Democratic field?
Well, I'll tell you why I never believed that, Bob, is because if you looked at when people were citing the popularity or approval, what's called the approval numbers for him in polls that supposedly showed he was unbeatable, there's another number that pollsters always take, but they don't always highlight, which is usually it's called the reelect number.
Mm-hmm.
You can't call that, you can't use that term with Bush. He wasn't really elected in the first place. You can't call it the reelect. So I call it the elect number. And it was always, you know, I don't want to say exclusively, but, you know, during that vast period when he was supposedly so popular, the reelect or elect number was below 50% in most surveys, even at the height of his political power. And the reason was that people had a perception that he wasn't really on their side all along, and the country remained as divided, under the surface, remained as politically divided as it was when he got into office. So I always took some hope from that the contradictions, as we would say, would reemerge in this political climate. And so the climate has changed. Indeed, those contradictions and doubts have emerged again, and he is now regarded as beatable because the personal approval numbers have dropped down much closer to the reelect number.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the reelect number has dropped at the same time, and in some polls it's below 40%, or it's in the low 40s. So that is the sign of a candidate who's in trouble, who has serious problems, particularly an incumbent president. Now, it's true that at other presidents at this stage in their presidencies have also experienced drops in their numbers. But I think that in a time when people feel that they were misled about something as serious as a war, and you know the news out of Iraq was terrible today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we got. In fact, I was going to ask you about that because it was on the NPR news right before we brought you on air.
Yeah.
Iraq could really damage his chances, I would imagine.
Oh, I think it has already.
Yeah.
I think it has already. People know that they were misled about this.
That's
a polite word.
Yeah, I was just going to say, for someone who titles a book Big Lies,
well,
suddenly you've got
the question about Bush is, did he know, you know, did he understand, did he pay enough attention to what was going on to understand that these things were not true? And that's always a question with him. You know, his powers of concentration are poor. And his intellectual abilities are not the greatest. But let's say he didn't understand, then he misled us.
Yeah.
Other people certainly have lied, and I think people know that now. I think reality has intruded on the myth of this presidency, and people are increasingly angry about it. I mean, I would say, by the way, I think one of the surprises next year is going to be the lack of support for the Republicans among military communities. And I think every liberal and progressive in this country ought to be reaching out to military families and military and service people and retired as well as active duty and saying, we care about what happens to you, we respect your service, and we would not misuse you the way these people have.
What about the Democratic field for president? What's your take on that crew, and do you have a dog in that race?
Don't have a dog in the race at this point. I will tell you I'll tell you who the most interesting candidates to me are, and in no particular order, Dean, Kerry, and Clark. I think they are the ones who have demonstrated qualities that make them plausible as presidents or potential presidents. Kerry, because of long public service and, in my view, a really a deep intellect and a fair amount of courage in the past about the kinds of positions he was willing to take and the things he was willing to do, and his military service, which is important now for reasons that have to do with the positioning of the two parties. Clark, for some of the same reasons, you know, really a brilliant guy who has done great service to the country in the past, and comes from a southern state. And has had some really serious responsibility in his life. Some of these candidates, to me, are not plausible as presidents. I mean, I think John Edwards is a very well-meaning guy, but as a freshman senator, I don't think he's ready.
Mm-hmm.
And Dean, because he's shown himself to be very independent-minded, smart about how to run a campaign, and adventurous, and you know, quite bold. I don't agree with him on all the issues, and I think he's. He may be a bit of a loose cannon as the candidate himself, but he's, you know, listen, he has tremendous popular appeal, and he may win the nomination.
Yeah.
And I think he certainly showed himself to be a competent governor, and his campaign is impressive for another reason, which is that no matter what happens to his candidacy, Dean has shown the way forward for the Democratic Party. He has shown the way to revitalize the party, the way to bring in new people, the way to activate younger people, and that's the future, and that's just undeniable. And
so
I think
we've got
a lot of credit for that.
We've got a full phone bank of people wanting to speak with you, so let's go and try to get them all in before the show ends. Champaign County, you're on the air with Joe Connison.
Yeah, I want to go away from the dog race aspect of politics for a moment and have actually two points to make, and that's I don't watch the cable stuff, so I don't know Ann Coulter from the occasional article, but I assume you spent some time on her. And she seems to be the Boykins of right-wing journalism because I believe she put to print that, you know, we ought to convert them all to Christianity, right? And I wonder whether she isn't part of, you know, that whole faction of the right that is...
She most definitely is not.
Is not.
No, she exploits that kind of sentiment. But I know Anne pretty well. And all the time that I've known her, she's lived in Manhattan and liked to hang out late in bars and has been a very active, socially active single woman. She at one time lived with the son of Bob Guccione, who owns Penthouse Magazine. So the idea that she's sort of a Christian conservative it's a cute idea and it's a funny idea, and she will enunciate those kinds of messages in order to please her audience. But I think if they knew what she's really like, they'd be very disappointed.
So that's basically just really just manipulative then. And
oh yes.
Yeah. Hmm. Okay.
But is she a member of the working class? I mean, I know a lot of these conservatives.
Is she a member of the working class? No. She grew up in. I happen to be from suburban New York in Westchester, and she grew up just over the border in Connecticut in a town called New Canaan, which is historically one of the most exclusive suburbs in the country. Blacks were never welcome there, and neither were Jews, for instance. Her father was a corporate lawyer who specialized in union busting and helped to break the strike of the copper workers at the Phelps Dodge plant in Arizona. So she is emphatically not from the working class.
Okay, now I just wanted to settle that. Caller, do you have another point you'd like to make?
She's manipulating a very dangerous topic, I think, which is this millennialist kind of Christianity. But what I wanted to ask about, I know you wrote a piece on the suppression of Greg Palast, a former guest of this show. I don't know if that it isn't really germane to your book, but if you had, I don't know whether you treated it at all in there, but I think it's a very interesting case of suppression of journalism, and it actually gets to the more, you know, directly links to corporate control of the media as opposed to these right-wing blowhards that seem to be the sort of the right-wing populist kind of. And okay. I know you have a full bank, so
let me get
whatever you have to say on that.
The Palast case, he's a very old friend of mine. The Palast case is a very complicated. It would take too long to even explain what it was, but I agree that it was it demonstrated a certain strategy.
I think our listeners probably don't even we've mentioned Greg on the show a few times. He was a guest over a year ago. But what is the case that we're talking about?
It was a case where he criticized a company called Barrick Goldstrike in Canada in when he was writing for The Observer in London, and they sued him and managed to try to suppress the story both over there and here, although his paper eventually stood up for him over there, despite the really bad libel laws that they have in England. I wrote about it in Salon as a way of sort of helping him and attacking them. And the Bush family was involved, too, because George Bush Sr. had become a board member. My memory of this is a little dim now. I don't want to make statements about it that could turn out to be wrong, but it was a very interesting case where...
But Palast has landed on his feet, hasn't he?
Oh, yeah, he's fine. He's been on the bestseller list for many, many weeks with his book, particularly in the paperback edition. He's done very well.
Let's go back to the
phone.
He's
back here now. He's an American.
Yeah.
He's come home.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Champagne, line one, you're on the air with Joe Connison.
Although I think it is important to understand alcoholism as an illness and some of these other things, I think it's too simplistic to say that liberals view these things as illnesses and conservatives view them as moral problems. I think the left gives up too much when it doesn't point out the moral vacuousness of many conservative points of view. I think someone like William Bennett is a perfect example of someone who lives in a extremely vacuous culture. He smokes. He's overweight. He gambles, and part of his problem is a profound moral problem. I don't think the left should give up talking about a certain kind of moral problem rooted in consumer culture, in a culture of lies, in a culture of...
I would say I agree with all of that, except I would just make it clear that I don't think the smoking or the obesity or the gambling are moral problems in themselves. It's his misuse of a moral stance while he's hypocritical about all these issues that is a moral problem. Maybe you'd agree with that.
I don't know. I mean, sure, I'm not going to say that smokers have a moral problem.
Right.
I'm just going to say that there's a pattern here of someone who, I mean, when I think of him, I think of someone who is never really challenges himself, who thinks that he's right and knows that he's right and lives in a culture which tells them that he's basically perfect all the time. And that goes to a broader sort of cultural moral issue. Not to blame it on
He's been pretty, but see, the culture actually helped to deflate him. In other words, there was no shortage of embarrassing coverage of him when his gambling addiction was revealed.
But the culture that helped to deflate him isn't really concerned with going into the more fundamental issues of why it
inspires
him in the first place.
Yeah, they never are. They moved on.
Just lift him up, take him down. Lift him up, take him down.
Well, he won't. I don't know that he'll be coming up so high again. But
well, sure. But we don't ask people on the left need to get beyond social science and ask themselves and not be afraid to articulate moral points of view that address some of these issues. And
I have to tell you, if you read chapter 6 of my book, you'll find it very pleasing. Because
okay.
I address this directly.
Okay, thanks
all right,
a lot.
Thank you for calling. Let's go back to the phone lines. Let's see. Next up, we've got Bloomington Normal. You're on the air with Joe Connison.
Oh, hi, thanks. It drives me a little crazy when liberals talk about New York and Miami and Los Angeles in terms of radio and television as the New York market or the Miami market or the L.A. market, because that really accepts the assumption that the purpose of radio and television is to sell products, because that's what a market is, where you buy and sell products, rather than to serve people. And I think liberals should adopt another term rather than markets to refer to these areas in the country. Also, another couple of points about Bush's electability. Don't forget that the man's going to have $200 million to play with after the primaries, and the Democratic candidate's going to be broke at the time. And thirdly, you mentioned that Kerry is a man of intellectual depth. That's not always an advantage in American politics, unfortunately. For example, Adlai Stevenson, Eugene McCarthy, and so on. There is a strain of anti-intellectualism in this country that looks askance at intellectuals occasionally.
Okay. Joe, do you have any comments you'd like to make on that?
Well, I would, the last comment I think is probably true, and I'm afraid that Kerry is demonstrating that now because his answers to all the questions are too long and too complicated. And if you learn to speak in sound bites. But you see, I mean, as a liberal, I try to live in the world as it really is and deal with it as it really is. And, markets are the way people in radio refer to the different cities. I mean, and you could think of it as a market of ideas as well as a market of commerce. I don't have any big problem with commerce, actually. And I think liberals ought to worry a little less about whether people want to sell things or not, because that's a lot of how this country works, and it's a lot of how the world works. And if you learn to deal with that and accept it, then you may be able to figure out a way to promote some progressive ideas in the same process. As far as the money in the election is concerned, I would just remind everybody, because I hear this kind of pessimism on the liberal left all the time, and I just think it's so it becomes an excuse for not doing anything. George W. Bush outspent Al Gore and Ralph Nader together last time by $65 million, at least. It probably was more than that, but that's what the FEC records show in terms of expenditures by the candidates themselves. Other Republican expenditures were even greater. And you know what? He lost.
Yeah.
He lost 51-49, if you add the center-left and left votes together against him. And Pat Buchanan spent $40 million and got less than, around 1% of the vote. So I'm not sure that money is the controlling factor. And I would also say, if you add up the amounts of money that the Democratic candidates have raised so far and compare that with what Bush has raised so far, you'd be surprised to find they're about equal.
Mm-hmm. When you put them all together.
And when you put them all together. And if you look going forward into next year, if you look at what organizations like MoveOn.org have been able to accomplish and the Dean campaign in terms of rapid fundraising, I will tell you, I think that the money race is going to be somewhat closer than people say it is. It's certainly not going to be 200.
That's great news for television station owners in this country.
Yeah. Well, it's actually good news for the country.
Well, let's go back to the phone lines and try to get these last callers in. Line 4, you're on the air with Joe Connison.
Yeah, I just want to quickly say that I believe Clear Channel's out of San Antonio.
Yeah, but Hicks is out of,
right.
Yeah, but Hicks, I think, is based
Hicks
in Dallas.
Hicks is in Dallas.
That's right.
Oh, I see.
All right.
And the other thing is that I wish the left would play up, especially around this Brown judicial nomination. Durbin at the committee hearings pointed out that the Democrats have proposed.
Oops, I accidentally deleted that caller, and I apologize.
He's talking about Janice Brown.
Yeah, why don't you want to just carry that on?
Well, I don't know what he was going to bring up about Janice Brown. She's an interesting case because she's an African American woman, and this is, you know, the Republicans, as I say in the book, have their own form of affirmative action, which is they'll find people of any race or ethnic background who will take on their views and promote them, and then complain if somebody doesn't want to vote for them because of their views, that person is committing an act of racial discrimination. So it's I mean, their misuse of race and the whole idea of affirmative action has reached a really laughable level of hypocrisy. And
I want to apologize again to that caller who I accidentally cut off. That's the first time I've done that in the show. Let's go to the last caller now. Line 3, you're on the air with Joe Connison. Hello? Yeah.
For me?
That's you, sir.
Yeah, sorry. Very quickly, it just seems to me that both liberals and Republicans have a fair dose of hypocrisy. And the further out the political spectrum someone stands, the if you scratch the surface, I think you will find a fairly large substance of hypocrisy. My expression is cynical, but I think it's a view that's fairly widely held and based on truth. Thank you.
Okay, what do you have to say to that, Joe?
I think there's probably some accuracy to that. My book is about the hypocrisy and the propaganda of one side that I think has been the dominant side in the debate. But I think it's actually healthy for everybody's failures and hypocrisies to be pointed out. And there certainly has been no shortage of them among liberals in the past.
You know, you've been traveling around the country promoting your book, it sounds like, for a while, Big Lies, the Right-Wing Propaganda Machine and How It Distorts the Truth. What has been, have you gotten a sense of the mood of the country, or has it changed? What is your vibe about this country politically right now?
I think what I sense and what I'm told by others who are doing the same thing that I am, like Al Franken and Paul Krugman, is that there's a tremendous revival of liberal and progressive activism and interest and I'd say a healthy dose of anger. I mean, I have not had one event scheduled for me anywhere where I have not had a capacity crowd. Sometimes that means 50 seats, and sometimes that's meant 200.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm the smaller fish here. I mean, Krugman and Franken will have, you know, Franken's had 1,200 people in places like St. Louis. I was booked into San Diego, which is not, you know, liberal territory, and I wondered why the publisher had done that, and I got there, and there were 125 people waiting for me outside at a little bookstore. This is happening. There's a huge audience. You can see it in the Dean campaign and Move On and a lot of other phenomena that people are fed up and they want to fight back.
Joe Connison, I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means it's time for me to clear out. Joe Connison, the author of Big Lies, the Right-Wing Propaganda Machine, and How It Distorts the Truth. Thank you for being our guest. I'm Bob McChesney. I'll be back 1 week from today with Media.